I don't know how many of you are like to read some of the classics. There is an individual called Leo Tolstoy, who is considered probably one of the top three novelists in all of history, all of time. He was born in Russia in the early 1800s. And he was born to a rich family. When he was born, he was automatically a count. And what's interesting about his story is he grew up in a Christian home, an Orthodox Russian home, and was taught the faith, went to Sunday school, went to church as a young man. But as he was growing up into his teen years, a whole wave and teaching of atheism swept through Russia. And as this news started to come out, more and more of his friends would walk up to him and say, "Well, I don't believe in God anymore." He was a bright guy. He was a very gifted student, and started to research and think and listen to the arguments. And eventually, he threw out his faith as well. He went on to university and moved into a lifestyle he would describe as loose. He partied lots. He was promiscuous. He was with lots of different women. He gambled a lot, and he lived life for all of its pleasures. Now, if you know, as he moved into his life, to decide what he would do, he was a writer. And eventually he would write some incredible books that would become world famous, one being the whole book called War and Peace. And this made him extremely rich and wealthy. And yet, as he was growing older, inside of him became a struggle, an anxiety, a disturbance, saying, I don't understand why I'm here. What's the purpose of life? Why should I live?" As he grew into adulthood and became famous and rich and wealthy and continued some of his lifestyle, eventually he met his wife, fell desperately in love with her. They had 13 children, and so it was like, well, maybe my life and purpose is about marriage and about kids. But soon that didn't seem to satisfy this deep struggle in his life. He had everything. He had title. He had fame. He had wealth. He had pleasure. He had everything, and yet, why am I here? What is my purpose? Couldn't seem to answer his question. He will tell in a book that he would later write 10 years after War and Peace. It's called A Confession. He would tell us that he literally came to the brink of suicide, that he needed a reason to live. And he strangely found it among the peasants of Russia. Each of them who had this deep faith in God, and no matter what the trial, no matter what the situation, held on to God and grew closer to God. He started to move into that journey and became born again. He became radically saved. In fact, it's interesting listening to the academics these days, because there's non-Christian academics who want to tell about his writings, and they don't know what to do with this spiritual transformation that happened in his life. He became a new man. Eventually, he would literally speak out about how the only ruler in his life was to be Jesus Christ. That was the only ruler. When people would ask him what caused the transformation, he would say to them, he'd say, "It was a question. The question changed me." And they would say, "Well, what is the question?" And he would say, "Well, what's the meaning of life? What's your purpose? Why do you live?" He said, "The fight to find that answer, and I found it in Jesus Christ, transformed me." This morning, we're going to look at questions, lots of questions. But questions that have that at this very center of it. Who are we? And these questions can transform us. Now, if you're visiting with us or haven't been with us before, we have been going through a study of the book of Job. It's one of the oldest books in the scriptures, and it's about a man named Job. And as we entered the study, the Bible tells the study we ran into this godly man who was devout in his faith, and yet was tested by God. And he was tested by God because Satan originally in heaven challenged and said, Job is only following you because you're giving him things. You're protecting him. And if you took those away, he wouldn't follow you. And God said, take your best shot. And Satan did. And Job held on to God. And then Satan comes back and he says, no. If you take his health, that'll do it. And so he took his health. And yet Job still hung on to God. Last week, as we move to the next phase or portion of the book of Job, Satan is gone, but three friends turn up in the place. And then a fourth turns up even beyond that. And they start to question or try to discern, so why are you suffering, Job? Like, what is it in your life that's causing that? And Job would respond repeatedly by saying, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong. We're born in sin, of course, but he sacrificed for that and covered that with the blood of the sacrifice. And he says, I've not done anything to oppose God. I've not done anything deviously sinful. I've not done anything to cause this suffering in my life. And they rebuked him and they came against him. And the intensity and the anger, as we talked about it last week, intensified. And then a fourth turns up and he has another slight twist of it. But all of them kept looking at Job saying, you got a problem. It's got to be you. Because they had this world view that God, there's bad people and good people, and God blesses the good people and he punishes the bad. So if you're suffering, it must be you. That was the thought. And Job says, that's not true. Throughout this conversation that took place, and that's the majority of the book of Job, Job says, and when I'm just quoting one of the Bible teachers that I came across, 36 times he said, if I only could talk to God. Other times he would use this court case scenario of said, if I could come before God and I could give my faith, my situation and explain it, God would know I'm innocent. And God has treated me unjustly. That's the phrase. That God has wronged me somehow. I haven't done anything wrong, so I shouldn't be suffering. That was his logic. But he kept saying, if only I could talk to God. Well, as we come to this chapters today, verse 38 and then to 41, God does turn up and God does talk with him. But don't miss the drama of this conversation. So Job and his three or four friends are sitting there. And suddenly in the distance, and this is Arabia, this is that area down south, and suddenly a whirlwind starts coming toward them, a big whirlwind, huge whirlwind, and it's coming directly toward them. Now, if you're Job, what do you think you'd think? On top of that, remember several months previously, his children had been killed by a whirlwind, a wind, and it had collapsed their house and killed all of his 10 children. And suddenly it's coming for him. And it's like, oh, I'm going to die. You can kind of read that through the line. And God comes into him in a whirlwind out of a storm. And then his voice starts to speak to Job and starts to talk to him. Now, here's the expectation of Job. The expectation is, God, you're going to come and I'm going to tell you my situation, and I'm going to get you to explain why you've made me suffer, because it's been unfair. When God gets there, he's not interested in that. He comes. Now, this is the longest, the Bible teachers will say, this is the longest direct speech from God directly in all of Scripture. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's four chapters. It's 124 verses, and I think it's four chapters. And so in this passage, God comes to him and says, I'm not going to talk to you about that. I'm going to ask you some questions. It's interesting the phrase he uses. It's kind of like, sit up, young man. I'm going to talk to you. Stand up. I'm going to talk to you. You listen to these questions, and I want you to answer these questions. That's kind of what he kind of says. He comes across almost stern. Who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? And so he stands before him, and God starts to ask him questions. Now, depending on how you go through the next chapters, you could list a number of questions. Some would say there's 77 questions. Another Bible teacher would say that, well, there's 86. It's just kind of how you divide it out. But he asks him a lot of questions. And what I want to do this morning is I want you to hear those questions or the themes of those questions, because you and I ask the same thing. We come to God and Lord, this has happened in my life. How come you let it happen? If we could only talk, if I could only hear your rationale and your reason and your justification, then maybe I'd be all right with you, God. And we need to hear these questions that God is asking. Now, it's interesting because as you move into the New Testament, Jesus would be confronted again and again by Pharisees and Sadducees and others who opposed him, and he'd always answer a question with a question. And this is what God the Father does. Now, let me break God's questions into four kind of categories, because it's important to see the themes or the overall approach that he uses to this, because I think you and I even today need to hear that. The first thing God does is start to ask him questions about the big things of life, about all of the big statements of life. Now, if you and I could put a label on it, he starts to talk to him. He says, Job, I want you to explain my creation. And as he starts to list, you'll see him list thing after thing after thing. He starts by saying, I want you to go back and say, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Can you imagine Job's face? It's like, when? Way back when you started? Yes. And he starts to say, and do you remember at that point when I put out the lines of and stretched the expanse of the universe? Do you remember when I established the cornerstone of earth? And Job's sitting there thinking, I wasn't there. I don't know this answer. I don't know how to answer that question. And then God goes to the creation and starts to ask even more specific. He says, do you remember when I birthed the seas? And he says, and you remember I placed the seas into the earth. And do you remember how we put borders around them or edges around them so they wouldn't go the land? And so the seas were established. He says, Job, where were you when the morning was created, when light was first done? And when he asked him, now understand this is all in Hebrew poetry, he would ask him, do you remember, where does the morning come from every morning? And where does the darkness go every time the sun rises in the morning and the light spreads its wings? And he says, do you understand, have you been to the gates of death? Now that can be translated or understood one of two ways. It could literally be the gates of death, where people go if they are to die, or it could be a reference to the deepest of deep seas. Now, I don't know if you know this. It's interesting how we can send satellites to Mars and walk on the moon, but there are places in our deep, deep ocean that our scientists have never been able to get to because of the depth and the pressure down there. They just can't get there. And God says, have you been there? Do you understand that? Just understand how this all works and how the firmament was made and how the seas were laid out and the land was established and the depths of the sea. And then he turns to me and he says, do you understand the storehouses where the snow is stored and the hail is kept? And it's interesting, his comment, he says, when judgment comes. And Job is sitting there, it's for when judgment comes. Do you know the two greatest armies that have ever marched were destroyed by snowflakes? The first was Napoleon. I think, if I remember, I'm going from the top of my head, I think it's over 340,000 troops marched toward Russia to conquer Russia. And it wasn't the Russians that defeated them, it was the winter of Russia. Later on, Hitler would do the exact same thing and march toward, and it wasn't the Russians that defeated him, it was the snow, it was the winter. And so in Judges, the Bible tells us that in Judges that there was this great battle, and God sent a hailstorm, and the hailstorm killed more soldiers from the enemy side than all of the Israelite soldiers combined did. God will use it even in Revelations, that hail becomes a tool of God's judgment. And he says, Job, do you know where that hail is stored? Then he talks about the rain and the wind and the clouds that envelope the... And he's asking him these broad questions. Do you know where the lightning comes from and where's it going? Do you know where the ice is made and stored and where the frost comes from? Do you know where the constellations are? And he has this incredible picture of the constellations, and he describes them as impacting Earth. And he talks about the Bear, or the Big Dipper is another name for it. And he talks about Venus and all these different constellations that impact. And he says, do you know how that all works? Now, if you're me, or if you're Job, and you're listening to these questions, it's like, I don't understand that. I don't understand. I can't explain to you how creation happened, how the universe functions, how the world was shaped, how the seas were made, and the rain and the snow and the clouds and how all that interact. I don't understand. I don't understand how hail and lightning and all of those work. And Job's sitting there almost aghast saying, I don't understand. And so it's almost like God looks at him. He says, that's interesting. He says, well, let's go a little smaller. Let's go into a little bit more simple things instead of the big question things. And he says, I want to talk to you about, can you maintain my creation? Can you maintain it? And he starts to show pictures of all kinds of animals, and it's really fascinating, the ones that he shows. And understand, he's looking at Job and saying, I take care of all creation. I take care of all the birds and worms and fish and animals and all of those all over. I control all of those things. I care for all of those things every day, all the time. Do you understand them, Job? Do you understand how to maintain them and take care of them? And he starts by saying, well, let me give you some illustrations. It's like, do you understand how the lion and lioness need to be fed every day and what kind of food that they need to take care of? And on the other hand, do you understand the raven and its hungry chicks? How do we feed them every day, and how does that happen? And how about the wild goats? Do you know when it conceives and how long that little goat stays in before it's birth? Do you know how long that takes, or the deer? He says, do you understand why it's not wise to harness a wild donkey that has grown up wild in the desert? And how do you know why it's not good to take a wild ox that had grown up in the wilderness and try to harness it and put it into a workplace? Do you understand the eagle and why it would build its nest way up there on the ledge on the cliffs? And do you understand the hawk and why it soars on the airstreams of Do you understand all of that? And do you know how to take care of each of those creatures, Job? And then he says, do you understand why this ostrich, this crazy bird that can't fly, has wings but that don't work and feathers that aren't needed? Do you understand how this bird has been made so that its eggs will be laid out on sand and kind of piled together for anybody to get to? And it, sometimes even that bird will step on it and break its own eggs. Do you understand it? And yet it has the capacity, the ability to run so fast, it's unbelievable. Do you understand that, Job? Do you know how to care for them? And then he moves, interestingly, to a war horse. He says, do you understand that I have made this war horse? that has a courage, a courageousness that as you go into battle, it is filled with anticipation and excitement, that wants to drive and charge into the fray and doesn't look back and has no fear and do you understand that? And why I've made it and how I have made it? And you can see Job is just kind of mumbling and stumbling now. He doesn't understand the big questions, but he doesn't even understand the smaller questions. And the Bible says he breaks in. And he breaks in, he says, "Oh Lord, I'm nothing. How could I ever find the answers? I will cover my mouth with my hand. I have said too much already. I have said nothing. I have nothing more to say." Translated, paraphrase. "Oh, if I hadn't opened my big mouth, I just got to shut up and quit saying things out loud. Go, Lord, I'm not going to talk anymore. I'm not going to question anymore. You know more than me. You know so much more than me." But it's interesting because God doesn't stop. It's like, "I'm not done with you, Job. I haven't asked you all the questions I've come to ask you. You've been waiting for me. You've been asking for me. You want me to come and talk to you. I'm talking. So here's the questions." And he goes on to a third set of questions. He says, "Can you judge the Creator? You have presumed to tell me that I'm doing wrong, and you are calling me a sinner so that you can be a saint? Well, let's see that for a little bit." And he says, it's about time you be the judge. You start to step into that place of being a judge. You start to live in that place. And I want you to look at sinners, and I want you to determine what they've done and their judgment and their punishment. I want you to put on your robes and all of those kind of things, as a judge would say, and I want you to sit at the bench, and I want you to judge the world, even to the point of condemning some to death because of their sin. I want you to do that, Job." And you can see Job kind of mumbling to himself, But I can't. I have no authority to do that. I have no right to judge other men. That's not my ability. I don't have that. I can't do that." And so the Lord looks at him again and says, "Okay, well, let's get really simple, Job. Let's get really practical. Let me ask you to do some things that are just easy." He says, "This is what I would like you to do." He says, "I want you to tame two creatures." Two creatures. Now, I don't know if you've heard of these two creatures. The first is called Behemoth. It's the only time in the whole Bible you hear its name. They've been debating forever, ever since I started reading it, what this creature is. Some will say it's an alligator. Others will say it's a hippopotamus. I remember my daughter came back from Africa, and when she came back from Africa, she had this twinkle in her eye, and she said, "Dad, do you know what the most dangerous animal in all of Africa is?" Of course, I said, "The lion." "Wouldn't you say the lion?" She says, "No, it's not the lion. It's the hippopotamus. It's the most dangerous animal in all of Africa." I'm saying, "Okay." And God brings this being forward. Now listen to the explanation. Is this a hippopotamus? He eats grass. Well, he's vegetables, likes his vegetables. His tail swings like a cedar. Have you ever seen the tail of a hippopotamus? It's this little thing. This isn't a hippopotamus. Could be an alligator then. It has powerful muscles. It has limbs like iron, and it can walk through a river. And he uses the Jordan as an example. The Jordan in flood, that this creature is so huge and so big, it can walk through a river. Now, as you start to look at this creature, I'm starting to think, I don't think this creature exists today. The closest, and some of you will kind of go a little crazy on this one, the closest I can see to this creature is a dinosaur that is extinct. There is a dinosaur called a ceropod. It is 10 times bigger than our largest elephant. 10 times. They said they would grow up to 80 tons. 80 tons. 120 feet long, 60 feet high. And they would walk around in herds. They've dug them up, and literally these incredibly large, they have hundreds of skeletons of them. They used to go around in packs, and they would eat off the top of the trees. Now, the thing about this thing is it's so huge and so big, it's like the scientists even today can't figure out how it functioned. How did it keep that weight? How much food did it have to eat every day? And all of these questions are coming to it, about it. But this may be what he's talking about. We don't quite know, but it seems to fit. Its legs are like logs. Its tail is like a cedar that swings back and forth. Huge, huge, huge. Now, this is what God says to him. I want to take you to Bemoth. This is what I would like you to do. I would like you, Job, I want you to take it and catch it. I want you to bring it home and make it your pet. How easy would that be, Job? Just, you know, come and bring it. It's a land creature like you. Come come and do that. And you can see Job kind of shaking his head. You could never catch it. You could never keep it. You couldn't put it in the living room. And it's like, Lord, I can't do that. And God says, okay. So if you don't want to capture a land creature, let me take you to capture a sea monster. And he brings forth Leviathan. Now, Leviathan is actually mentioned repeatedly throughout Scripture, a lot of times. And we've been trying to figure out what it is. Again, some people think because it's about water and sea that maybe it's an alligator. Others think it may be a huge, huge whale. But listen to some of the descriptions of it. It has enormous strength, a graceful form. Its chest is as hard as rock. It is covered with scales, as you look at the various translations where it's covered with scales that are so tightly together that literally if you take a spear or an arrow, it can't pierce it. It's like an armor. Its back has a row of shields. That's the description. There's scales that are big and wide down the back. And it's huge. And it can't be pierced. It has a mouth with fearsome teeth. And then it says this, and fire and smoke come out of its mouth. And it says there's no creature on earth its equal. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'm hearing a whale. I don't think I'm hearing an alligator. I know this sounds strange, but I think that I am hearing about a dragon. Now, is God using an illustration here that everybody kind of knew about? Possibly. Or is this something that was extinct? Possibly, but we've never found any evidence of it. You know what's interesting about the dragon? The dragon, if you go back to all the ancient cultures, everyone that has any records way back there of their ancient stories or ancient descriptions of incredible beasts all describe a dragon that breathes fire and smoke. I don't know if this is real. It may not even matter if it's real because God is speaking a picture to Job saying, can you catch one? Now, this is the picture God uses. I want you to get your fishing bowl. I want you to get your little boat. I want you to go out in the sea. I want you to cast it. I want you to catch it. I want you to put it in your creel or your little fisherman's basket. Can you do that for me, Job? Can you catch it with a hook and make a pet of him? And Job is shaking his head and saying, can't do that either, Lord. Can't do that. And the Lord, it's almost as if he looks at him, he doesn't even have to say it. Two of my creations, big creations, but just two creations. And they're too powerful and they're too strong for you to control. And yet you think, Job, that you're powerful enough to control me? You have the influence enough to control me? this ends the discussion that he has. And I started to step back and say, okay, this is so many details. There's so many questions, 77 questions or 86 questions, whatever it is. It's like, Lord, what's your point? What are you trying to communicate? Let me put it this way. Job, where were you at the beginning? And the answer is, I wasn't there. I wasn't there to watch the earth be formed. I wasn't there to shape it. I wasn't there to design it. I wasn't there to make it. I wasn't there. Okay. Did you create the seas and the stars and the constellations and the rain and the snow? And no, I didn't. Okay. Can you take care of all of these creatures in this world? No, I can't. I'm just one guy. Well, can you judge? Do you have authority to judge? And he says, Lord, you know you have the authority. I don't have the authority. I can't judge. God looks at him almost to respond in this way. He says, so why is God accountable to you? Why do you want God to stand before you and talk to you and give you reasons why he should do this or not do that? Why is that? If you don't have the power, the knowledge, the authority, why not? And then the last question, do you have the power to control these things that are great? And the answer is no. And God's response almost is, do you think you can control God? You've said 36 times, if God was standing before me, I would get my case and I would say he's unjust and I would tell him he's got to reconcile with that. Now pause for a sec. Do you do that? I do. He's like, God, why is this happening to me? Why did you let this happen to me? God, I want an answer from you. And God's saying, who are you to ask me that? Who are you to say, I want to count you to be accountable? God says, I have the authority and I have the power. I have the knowledge and understanding. I am overseeing all of this, and I've designed this and made this. Who are you to call me to account, Job? There's an interesting story. I don't know if some of you have even read it to your kids, called the Narnia Tales. In the Narnia Tales, God is represented by a huge lion called Aslan. And if you read the story, things happen to it that no one expects. No one expects it to be killed, and that no one expects it to raise from the dead. And you could go through the whole story. It's a great read by C.S. Lewis, The Narnia Tales. At the end of the story, and I am fishing from the bottom of my head here, at the end of the story, Aslan is leaving. They have saved the day, they have won the victory, and only through Aslan has that victory been won, and he's leaving. And I want to say Wendy, but I might be wrong on that. The little girl and one of the other characters are standing watching him go away. And the character says to this little girl, he says, you know, he's not tame. You know, he is a great lion and a powerful lion, but he's not tame. He's wild, is the implication. He's not to be controlled, is the implication. And the little girl turns up and says, yeah, but he's good. He's not tame, but he's good. See, our God is all powerful and all knowing. And able to create and to manage this incredible world and universe. He has all authority and all power. And somehow, in some ways, we walk up to him and say, hey, how come you're doing that to me? How come you're letting this happen to them? And we have to take a step back and ask ourselves, if he answered, could we even understand him? You see, there's an arrogance in us that somehow he's accountable. Somehow he has to explain himself. Somehow he has to prove what he did was a good thing. Now, let me move some of you from a place, because when we started in Job, what was interesting about Job is Satan comes to God and says, I want to test him. That's what he says. And so we watch this test, and it's awful. It's horrible. It's painful. It's like, God, you're letting this happen. Why are you letting this happen? And then on top of that, his health breaks down. God, come on, really? And it's like in us saying, God, why did you let Satan do this? I thought you're supposed to protect us. I thought you're supposed to love us. But when that portion was over, God continued, for his plan for Job was deeper and richer and better than just a test from Satan. But does God explain it? He doesn't. Because he doesn't feel he needs to. Or he doesn't think he'll understand. Do you understand how creation was all put together and formed and shaped? I don't. I laugh at some of these guys who are atheists, because they'll talk about this incredible universe and they'll go on and on about this incredible universe. Let me ask you a question. We have all the stars and the universes and the solar systems and all of that. What does it sit in? What does it rest in? Where does it reside? It's like, they talk about the Big Bang Theory and all that. But where does this all reside? And where did that come from? It's like no one wants to talk about that anymore. Because God's ways, God's abilities are so beyond us, we haven't even known how to ask the questions. And so there are times when God will bring events and struggles and sufferings, even tragedy into our life, and we'll say, but I don't understand, I want to know. And God will say, I could explain it, but you won't get it. You won't understand it. In fact, the danger of it, even the question, is you will think that you're in the position, that you have the authority to judge me as right or wrong. So what's the bottom line? If he knows all of this, if he manages all of this, as he has great authority and great, great power, how do we respond when suffering comes? The response is simple, incredibly hard. We trust him. Can you trust God or submit to God through that? That's really the bottom line. He's not going to explain it all, at least this side of earth, of heaven. He's not going to give you a rationale and let you sit in judgment of him of okay, God, I guess it was worth it. He's not going to allow us to do that, because that is disrespecting him and his power and his authority. And so God wants you to move into a position where you recognize that he is the creator of all things, that he manages all things, even your individual life, that he has authority to judge what is right and wrong in all of life, and he has the power to make happen what he needs to make happen. And then trust him with that. Let me give you a verse. I would love you to take this verse. It's actually two verses, but I'd love you to take it this week and just read it over and over and over again. Get it in your head. Because I think it will help you move when you get stuck with the issues of suffering, when you get caught up of saying, Lord, I keep getting this why question. I can't get past it. I want you to hear this, for it's critical that you understand it. Here's the verse. It's coming out of the book of Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. This is what the verse said. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. Superior, supreme, above, deeper, richer. And my thoughts than your thoughts. There comes a point in our spiritual journey that as we walk through life, it's like, Lord, I'm not going to get it all. I'm not going to understand it all. But I'm going to trust you. I'm going to put my faith in you, and I'm going to walk with you. And maybe on the other side, on heaven's side, you'll help me understand it. But right now, when my feeble mind and my lack of power and my lack of authority, I don't have any of those things. Lord, when that happens, I'm going to just trust you. I'm just going to put my faith in you. I'm just going to hold on to you. I'm just going to walk with you. And I'm never going to leave you because I know you are the best thing that ever happened to my life. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, sometimes we get frustrated when we don't have all the answers. The question is, do we have you? And I would ask that if there are those today who are going through really, really difficult times, they have been so fixated on getting the right answer from you that they have missed the right person. We need you in our life because you have designed all things. We need you in our life because you manage all that goes around our life. We need you in our life because you have the authority and you have the power to walk with us and help us to be victorious, no matter what the devil or the world throws at us. I would ask that you would be with each one here and help them on their journey to hold tightly to you and trust in you, even when it is beyond their understanding and beyond their comprehension. Let us hold on to you, for we know that we serve the living God, all maker of heaven and earth. I ask this in Jesus' name.